Well, thank you, Mrs. Whitdiamond. I'm pleased to be here. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like in the first place to read a group of six poems. These represent the work that I've been doing for the past year or more, or the best of it. And I think they hang together. Most of these poems are unpublished yet. The first of them has been published, however, in Book 4. And it's called Under St. Paul's. And this poem, I have been told and can well believe, is obscure, which I don't like. And so perhaps I can say just a few words of explanation to make it less obscure, as little obscure as may be. It starts as simply my impression of a visit to St. Paul's Cathedral in London, and particularly to the crypt of St. Paul's under that building, and my impression of the London skyline in that area of London, the Dome of St. Paul's and the belfries of the city churches. And then it tries to go to the spiritual realities that these visual phenomena stand for. Under St. Paul's. Wren and Barry, Rennie and Milne and Dance, under the flags, the men who stood for stone lie in the stone. Carillons, pigeons once, sluiced Ludgate's issues daily, and the dome of stone-riveted crystal swung and hung its wealth of waters. Wren had plugged it home with a crypt at the nerve of London. Now the gull circles the dry stone nozzles of the belfries, each graceful city hydrant of the full, eagerly brimming measure of agreement, still to be tapped by any well-disposed, conversible man, still underneath the pavement, purling and running, affable and in earnest, the condit candor. Fatally urbane, under the great drum, pigeons foul their nest. The whiter wing, anger, and the gulls, sheer water raucous over hunting hulls, seek London's river. Rivers underground, under the crypt, return the sound of footfalls in the evening city. Out of wells, churchyards sunk behind Fleet Street, trickle smells of water where a calm conviction spoke, now dank and standing. Leaves and our debris choke the bell note candor that the pavior heard, floating and swelling like a crop-filled bird. So sound the tides of love. Yet man and woman may be my world's first movers, and the stream still run no darker, nowhere deeper than conviction's claim upon us, to deny nothing that's undeniable. Light airs are bent to the birds that couple as they fly and slide and soar, yet answer to the flow of this broad water under. There we ride, lent to the current, and convictions grow in those they are meant for. As conviction's face is darker than the speculative air, so and no darker is the place for candor and love. What fowl lives under water, breeds in that dark? And hadn't a contriver of alphabets, Cadmus, the gull for daughter? Across the dark face of the waters flies the white bird, and the waters mount, or should mount. We grow surer of what we know, if no surer of what we think. For on aging, laboring now, and subsiding, and nerveless wing, the gull sips the body of water, and the air, packed at that level, can hold up a minster in air. Across the dark face of the water flies the white bird until nothing is left but the water. Well, the second poem I want to read is one which I hope will reflect back on that one and make it a little clearer. It's about the same notion of candor as an important principle which meant something rather different 200 years ago from what it does today. And this poem is called Against Confidences. And it's written in dimeters, 2 feet to the line, arranged in rhyming quatrains. Against Confidences. Loose lips now call candor friend, whom candor's brow, when clear, contemned. candor can live within no shade that our compulsive needs have made, on couches where we sleep, confess, couple and share a pleased distress. Not to dispense with privacies, but reticence, his practice is. Agreeing where is no denial, not to spare one truth from trial, but to respect conviction's plight in intellect's hard equal light. Not to permit to shy belief too bleakly lit the shade's relief clouds candor's brow, but to indulge these mouths that now divulge, divulge. Now the third poem that I read is called Killala, and it's like the first one in that it starts from an impression of a particular scene at a particular moment and tries to proceed from that to a further topic, I suppose a metaphysical question of identity, what personal identity is. And the scene in this case is defined in the title, Killala. Killala Bay is a place on the west coast of Ireland where a French expeditionary force landed briefly in 1798 in order to assist the Irish in one of their periodic risings against the British. Killala Bay, and it's on a particularly desolate part of the coast of County Mayo, a place which is rendered even more desolate by the squalor of the modern building that has gone on around it. Killala. Forlorn indeed hope on these shores, white-breeched under a tree corn, shouting orders into the wind in a European language, La Gloire against the Atlantic, and Enniscrone, the unfocused village carefully grouped on absence. Laden with Europe, toiling up out of the sea with all the baggage of their own and Europe's history barnacled, clammy with tawny jellies and spotted silts, the wreck of unwashed hope is a more combustible flotsam than this, more stranded, more featureless than any conurbation. Not memory, her lading, nor the vessel. No, nor the vessel, for the Temeraire has been a dozen ships and all one venture, but the venture persists. Such a temerity, so bare a chance, deserves a barer rocks, less cluttered landfall. Nakedness is structural, asks a binnacle at sea, by land, if not an oak, a standing stone, hewn or unhewn, in an open place, for the venture to take a shape by. But the prudent gale, disguised on the skyline as habitation tatters the scarecrow coast, has blurred identity by blurring shape, a flutter of rags in the wind. Frenchmen, the beacons flare across the Midlands, stopping the car and hating this ugly place. Let this be as if I had lit the first of the beacons, of driftwood fetched from the shore, announcing your identity and presence. Not an idea, abstract notion, quality, but a being only, able for life and action. The same it was some time ago in France. Well, now there's a poem that goes with that one, and I hope makes it more clear. It's again dealing with the same sort of problem of identity. And this is called Coastal Redwoods. So you see that I am, this is one of the poems for which I am grateful to California. Coastal Redwoods. Imagination moves, along with damping reason, through unimpressive trees in famous giant groves. For trunks of girth with this dead trunk, its rings all numbered, need not have lived its sum of close-packed centuries, since trees, no two the same, disguised from the beginning, grow through thick rings or thin, and dead make good their claim. Thus, proven ancientness, in the felled tree perfected, in this that sways erect, falls short of that success. All this I felt and knew. But computation's logic disowns, yet can't dislodge, the doubt I venture to. For beings that no power from age to age can measure, reason must no less suspect from hour to hour. What its discoverer saw is not this tree. How, even, is this which I perceive that of the day before? From mutable bark and leaf, mere bulk's persistence, idle, my boredom justified, I turn in mild relief. And meet identity's presence, achieved self-sameness, being that proves its claim living, a tree of trees. 230 feet stout, tapering, unbroken, poured to the sky, and spoke to shame the exegete. Of all that noble stand, noble locution, only beauty, beauty alone, blunts axe and numbering hand. Well, now here's another poem, one of the more difficult and longer ones, which again has to do with a place. The title of this is St. Ives, which is a coastal harbour in Cornwall, England, which has become a centre for painters, and that I think is all you need to know about it. You don't get to it until in the middle of the poem. Why, by an ingrained habit, elevate into their own ideas activities like carpentry become the metaphors of graining, gardening, the one word tilth, or thought, the idea of having ideas, resolved into images of tilth and graining. An ingrained habit. This is fanciful. And there's the rub bristling where the irritable block screams underneath the blade of love's demand, or in crimped and gouged out shavings only looses under appealing logic its perceptions. Language, mine when wounding, yours back-biting, lacks no wall nor one-way shelving. It resists, screams its remonstrance, planes reluctantly to a level, and the most reasonable of settlements betrays unsmooth resentment under the caress. The purest hue, let only the light be sufficient, turns colour, and I was told, if painters frequent St. Ives, it is because the light there under the cliff is merciful. I dream of an equable light upon words, and as painters paint in St. Ives, the poets speaking. Under that cliff we should say, my dear, not what we mean, but what the words would mean. We should speak as carpenters work with the grain of our words. We should utter unceasingly the hue of love, safe from the battery of changeable light. Love, a condition of such fixed colour, Cornwall indeed, or Wales, might foster. Lovers in mauve, like white-robed druids, or the bards in blue, would need a magical filter, no less, like Iseult's, to change partners. Such a fourth estate of the realm, hieratic, unwinking, mauve or blue under sky steel silver, would chamfer away a knot in the grain of a streaming light, the glitter of lancers' points that moved a sluggish froisseur to aesthetic feeling. And will the poet, carpenter of light, work with the grain henceforward? If glitterings won't fetch him, nor the refractory crystal, will he never again look into the source of light, aquiline, but fly always out of the sun, unseen till softly alighting? Why, by an ingrained habit, elevate into the light of ideas the colourful trades, if not like Icarus to climb the beam? Highlights are always white, but this ideal sun dies only more intensely, and we find enough cross-graining in the most abstract nature. And then the shorter poem that goes with that same one, and I hope makes it clearer, is called An Anecdote of Transitions, and it uses the same conceit, the distinction that painters make, I understand, between colour which is tone, that is to say is created and modified by the light, and the colour which is hue, which exists independent of light to a greater degree. Anecdote of Transitions. Against the degrees, the Chinese, robes of office, the scarlet, the saffron grades, the sage has put on dresses the sun discolors, fades, less firmly structured and softer shades of white light fractured or disintegrated, indigo, violet, so womanish his abstracted habit. Challenged, this hue, is it for you right? The master remarks on light, the light of mine. Never so abstract, so refined a thought, but faster hue there in his than they can bleach, can master. Well, that then concludes the group of six poems which represent my most recent work. Now I'd like just to finish off with a few shorter poems that were written earlier. And they're easier going, I think, for me, and I hope for you too. The first one is called Mushroom Gatherers. It explains itself, except that I have to say that it is an imitation of a very short passage from a great poem in Polish, the Pan Tadeusz of Adam Mickiewicz. The Mushroom Gatherers. Strange walkers, see their processional perambulations under low boughs, the birches white and the green turf under. These should be ghosts by moonlight wandering. Their attitudes strange. The human tree slowly revolves on its bole. All around, downcast looks, and the direct dreamer treads out in trance his lane, unwavering. Strange decorum. So prodigal of bows, yet lost in thought and self-absorbed, they meet impassively, without acknowledgement. A courteous nation, but unsociable. Field full of folk, in their immunity from human ills, crestfallen and serene. Who would have thought these shades are lively friends? Surely these acres are Elysian fields. Then there's another short poem, it's only 12 lines long, and it's called A Baptist Childhood. A Baptist Childhood. When some were happy as the grass was green, I was as happy as a glass was dark, till I, beneath the chapel floor, unseen most of the year, a mystery, the ark. Above board rose the largely ethical, glossy with graining pulpit. Underground, the older scriptures trembled for the fall and lapped at Adam with a sucking sound. Grass-rooted goodness and a joy unmixed, parch unbaptized inside a droughty head. Arcadia's floor is not so firmly fixed, but it must tremble to a pastor's tread. Now here's a poem called Obiter Dicta, which is, as you will see, about my father and my relation to him. Obiter Dicta. This is rather longer. Trying to understand myself, I fetch my father's image to me. There he is, augmenting the treasury of his prudence with a clutch of those cold eggs, great truths. His scrivener's hand confiding apothegms to his pocketbook. Does mine do more than snap the elastic band of rhyme about them? In an age that teaches how pearls of wisdom only look like eggs, The tide Aflatus still piles up on the beaches pearls that he prizes, stones that he retrieves misguidedly from poetry's undertow, deaf to the harsh retraction that achieves its scuttering backwash, ironies. And yet, recalling his garrulity, I see there's method in it. Seeming to forget the point at issue, the palmer tells his beads, strung by connections nonchalantly weak, upon the thread of argument he needs to bring them through his fingers, round and round, tasting of gristle, savoury. And he hears, like rubbing stones, their dry, conclusive sound. Himself an actor, he can play the clown. He knows the poet's a man of parts. The sage is one of them. Buffoonery like his own means to an end. So, if he loves the page that grows sententious with a terse distinction, yet lapidary moralists are dumb about the precepts that he acts upon, brown with tobacco from his rule of thumb. Not bread but a stone, the deep sea fishermen denounce our findings, father. Pebbles, beads, perspicuous dicta, gems from Emerson, whatever stands when all about it slides, whatever in the oceanic welter puts period to unpunctuated tides, these that we love, they hate. And after all, for you to take, but with a pinch of salt to take, the maxims of the sages is the true great truth of all. To keep, as you would say, a sense of proportion, I should portion out the archipelago across the bay, one island to so much sea. Assorted poetic pleasures come in bundles then, strapped up by rhyme, not otherwise supported. Turning about his various gems to take each other's lustre by a temperate rule, he walks the graveyard where I have to make not centos but inscriptions and a hole that's moved from inward dancing. Yet I trace among his shored up epitaphs my own. Art, as he hints, turns on a commonplace, and death is a tune to dance to, cut in stone. And my last poem is again a brief one with the title Time Passing Beloved. Time passing, and the memories of love coming back to me, Carissima, no more mockingly than ever before. Time passing, unslackening, unhastening steadily, and no more bitterly, beloved, the memories of love coming into the shore. How will it end? Time passing, and our passages of love as ever, beloved, blind as ever before. Time binding, unbinding about us, and yet to remember never less chastening, nor the flame of love less like an ember. What will become of us? Time passing, beloved, and we in a sealed assurance unassailed by memory. How can it end, this siege of a shore that no misgivings have steeled, no doubts defend? Thank you very much.